Hello, I'm Garth Sundem. This is number 0146, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0146. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Frank M. Ahern, author of The Digital Man. He can help you to eradicate the unwanted parts of your history that may appear online.
The big problem today is newspapers are starting to upload every issue they ever printed. And you may have done something 10 years ago that was really stupid, like got drunk, went streaking, and got arrested. And you just figured it was long behind you. So what's starting to take place are digital skeletons stepping out of the closet. Plus, it's other people putting up the information, being at a party and drunk or doing something stupid, and they, upload a video or upload a photo of you.
Bob DiRigo Jones, author of Remove the Child Before Folding. He's also the guy behind the annual Wacky Warning Labels contest.
Judges need to be the gatekeepers to the courts that they were intended to be, so that when somebody, for example, catches his teeth in a basketball net while dunking a ball and then sues the net maker, that case is dismissed rather than resulting in $50,000 like that one did. As judges hear us talking about this, but more importantly, as the public becomes aware of how they pay, even if they're never sued themselves, that puts pressure on the judges to do what they're supposed to do.
A retro interview with a star no longer with us, this time around the late Buddy Ebsen, best known for his role as Jed Clampett on the Beverly Hillbillies. He was originally cast to play the Tin Woodsman in The Wizard of Oz, but his system didn't quite get along with the makeup.
They powdered me with aluminum dust, and it got into my lungs, and I got instant emphysema, and it was pretty serious, so I was replaced.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0146, was Garth Sundem, who is the author of Brain Trust, 93 Top Scientists Reveal Lab-Tested Secrets to Surfing, Dating, Dieting, Gambling, Growing Man-Eating Plants, and More. Thank you very much, Garth, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Much appreciated. The Stuff File program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, here's a pro tip for you. Hiding in a nudist camp after robbing a hardware store won't work very well if you're not willing to take off your clothes. In Kissimmee, Florida, 20-year-old homeless man Milton Hodges allegedly jumped a wall to get into the Cypress Cove nudist resort after robbing two cashiers at a Lowe's. Once inside the nudist resort, Hodges allegedly drew a large knife from his pants and carjacked a golf cart from the security guard. However, being one of the few folks actually wearing clothing, he was easily spotted by deputies who arrested him at gunpoint. "We usually don't get the outside world coming through our gates like that," said Ted Hadley, owner of the 48-year-old resort. "We don't get a lot of crime at the Cove, so this was definitely unusual for us. Definitely a lot of excitement." Yeah, well, you know why there's not a lot of crime? Very few concealed weapons. Yeah. Okay, so you got your sea salt, your kosher salt, and your regular Morton's table salt, but salt made from human tears? Hoxton Street Monster Supplies in London says yes, and claim the salts come from crying humans experiencing a range of emotions. At $10 a bottle, the salts claim to be harvested from tears of sorrow, tears shed while sneezing, tears shed while chopping onions, tears of laughter, and tears of anger. And a spokeswoman for the company even goes so far as to claim that each salt had a distinctly different flavor. A company spokesperson said salt made from tears combines century-old craft with the freshest human tears, which are gently boiled, released into shallow crystallization tanks, then harvested by hand, and finally rinsed in brine. Yeah. I'm not sure I want the distinct flavor of sneezing salt. Yeah. Anyway, we all know he's from the dark side and all, but police in Toledo, Ohio certainly didn't expect Darth Vader to actually rob a bank. Now a manhunt is on for the suspect who stormed into the Huntington Bank and demanded money from staff while dressed as Star Wars Darth Vader and brandishing a semi-automatic pistol. And in a very un-Darth Vader-like move, the thief, believed to be in his early to mid-20s, escaped with an undisclosed amount of cash and sped off on his BMX bike. Police do not believe the man was carrying a lightsaber at the time. Luke, I am your robber. Okay, while we all hate the horrible things he did, one almost has to admire the efficiency of alleged superfelon William Todd. According to police, Mr. Todd arrived in Nashville, Tennessee via Greyhound bus and faced a 9-hour layover. Oh, what to do, what to do, what to do. Well, rather than relax or take in the sights, police say Todd committed at least 11 felonies during that time, one after another, with more charges still possible. Among Todd's alleged activities, shooting up a restaurant, setting it on fire, robbing four people at a bar, carjacking, breaking into a law office and defecating on a desk, trolling hotel rooms seeking theft opportunities, and stealing a taxicab and robbing the driver. He was finally captured and arrested at Oprahland, where he had hidden it by submerging himself in water up to his nose. One police sergeant said, "I've never seen anything like this before." Well, that's rather industrious. Could you imagine what he'd accomplish if he tried to actually do good instead of evil? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our first guest on the program, police in Salisbury, Maryland arrested 48-year-old Kelly Irvin and charged him with littering under 100 pounds. According to police, Irvin routinely goes for a long run every morning at 4 o'clock and, as part of his routine, has a bowel movement after about 2 miles. That means most days he's relieving himself in the same neighborhood, whose residents, needless to say, have been complaining. When questioned by police, Irvin basically shrugged and said he thought many distance runners all do the same thing. Well, guess the neighbors should count their blessings. The charge was under 100 pounds. On to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A couple of years ago, we talked with Frank Emma Hearn about his book, How to Disappear. Well, he has a new book out called The Digital Hitman. So we found Frank again, only because he led us, and he's on to talk about his latest book from Parts Unknown. Hi, Frank.
Hey, how you doing? And thanks for having me. Very much appreciate it.
I'm fine. Nice to have you back on the program. Now, I'm assuming that there are two groups of people out there. Those who are completely oblivious of the digital footprint they're leaving everywhere they go, and those who are aware of their digital footprint but feel powerless to do something about it. So I'm assuming that you can educate one and help the other.
Yeah, that's actually a very good assessment of it, you know, which is like a perfect way of looking at it. The big problem is some people are just totally unaware of the footprints they're leaving behind or how to deal with the negative information as far as like digital footprints and things like that.
Now, the negative information that's out there, is this information like, putting risque pictures up on Facebook or stuff like that? In other words, is it information that the person puts up themselves, or is it information that's put up about them?
It could be all of the above. I mean, the big problem today is newspapers are starting to upload every issue business are printed, okay? And you may have done something 10 years ago that was really stupid, like, got drunk, went streaking, and got arrested. And you just figured it was long behind you. So what's starting to take place are digital skeletons are like stepping out of the closet. Plus, it's other people putting up your information, being at a party and drunk or doing something stupid, and they, upload a video or upload a photo of you. So, you know, it kind of hits you from all ends, your past, your present. Things you do presently, they're just stupid. And it's a difficult thing to, I guess, combat.
Okay, so let's talk about that. The first example you mentioned, the newspaper. Newspapers are putting up, as you say, everything that they've ever printed. So how do you combat that? I mean, it's the newspaper's site. They put it up there. How do you divorce yourself from whatever may be there about you?
Well, basically what the plan to do is to create, like, fake digital identities. You know, let's say you did something stupid 5 years ago and it's in the newspaper today. What I would do is I would create multiple websites, multiple blogs using your name, and then the information, the negative information about you, I would probably create a blog and a website that would say somebody in Ohio is taking, you know, credit for that negative information. You know, and their blog would be like, you know, 5 years ago I did this really stupid thing, you know, and check out this article about me. So what happens is when somebody puts your name, you know, in a search engine, several, you know, a ton of information about you is going to come up, but then there's going to be that negative information. And somebody's going to say, wow, I thought that was Peter who did the radio show. And it's like, well, no, it's a guy in Ohio. Just they share the same name. And that's an actual problem that's happening today as well.
It also sounds like by putting other stuff in on the web, you're kind of burying stuff below. In other words, keeping it further down in the search engine so it doesn't appear anywhere near the top. Is that another?
Well, yeah, but that's not really it's not a foolproof thing because everybody's aware of it, you know. When you're looking for dirt on somebody, you go beyond page 1, 2, and 3 of Google. You know, the key is to somewhat like off the information on somebody else. So this way, when they find the negative information on page 7, it's not going to be, you know, Frank Aaron from New York. It's going to be Frank Aaron who lives in Scranton, Pennsylvania. So that's really the goal. The goal is to manipulate the information so it appears to be someone else and not you.
So flipping that to the other side, how can one ever trust information that's online? Not that we're trusting it now, but I mean, as you're saying, it seems to be one of the most successful things to eradicate your digital footprint is to create a false one.
Exactly, because you know what I've learned, like going back over a year ago, was people were constantly emailing me saying, "Listen, there's this information about me. Can you delete it? You know, what can you do?" And I just realized, you know, you can't delete this stuff. So, but maybe I can use deception and start creating digital deception or digital twisting, as I like to call it. And that is the only way to combat information, because just because you email a website, it doesn't mean they're going to take it down. The other problem is, you know, there could be 50 blogs out there with your information. And the problem is you can't contact the blogs. You have to sign up, you know, leave a posting, you know, about the article, and it doesn't mean they're going to help you. So it's a huge issue. There's no delete button. And that's problematic for a lot of people.
And well, how about this? I'm going out on a limb now for a radical idea. Just owning up to your past.
Well, unfortunately, you know something, you get a good point there. But a lot of us have made some stupid mistakes. And unfortunately, you know, that could be a problem with your job. But, you know, let me just like change it in a different direction. I have a client who used to be a prosecutor in New York. She's retired, private practice. She put a bunch of high-level criminals in prison. They're coming for parole, and she says to me, "Listen, I just want you to look into my information online and tell me what you can locate about me." The problem was not her information, but I located her 16-year-old daughter and a connection to her, where the 16-year-old daughter went to school, who her friends are, cheerleader, everything about her. So what I did was use the same technique where I just built a lot of information surrounded around her daughter. So the deception also worked in a way for people who needed to protect themselves, not just somebody who's looking to forget the past. And, you know, as far as forgetting the past, you know, not everybody can face the past. So the deception is like it's a tool that's used in many different ways for security as well.
I look at some of the big cases that have been around over the last little while. Of course, there is President Clinton when he got in trouble. There is John Edwards when he got in trouble. And in a lot of cases, what we're talking about here is it wasn't so much the so-called crime that was committed, but the lying after. Isn't that a little bit what we're talking about here? In other words, if you're saying that a boss, you don't want your boss finding out some of the things you did, by covering it up with a lie, isn't that making it worse if you're found out?
Yeah, but the goal is not to be discovered. And so the truth is, you know, if I take somebody's information and I create somebody on the other side of the country who takes credit for it, the assumption is, wow, you know, this is not Frank from New York, it's some guy Frank in California. And there's really, it'd be very difficult to prove, you know, unless there's a court record and there's a mugshot and the mugshot's online or if there's an actual picture. So, you know, it's a difficult thing to, I guess, prove or just chip away and locate the actual truth to it. But getting caught would be a problem, no doubt about that.
Okay, so you're a privacy expert. And as I mentioned, author of this book, The Digital Man. Being a privacy expert, do you ever get clients who come to you who are actually the bosses wanting to find out something about someone?
I had people contact me, you know, in those things, and I started to work on it. But then I decided, you know something, that's not what I do. You know, I want to stay on one side of the fence and not get involved in, quote, discovering the information. I just like the burying of it, and I'm pretty good at it, so I'm just sticking to that side of the street.
Who do you believe your prime target is for buying your book, The Digital Hitman, His Weapons for Combating the Digital World?
Anybody who has something online that is making their life miserable or has the potential of making their life miserable or has something, piece of information that puts them in danger. I don't think it's any, you know, particular age. I don't think it's particular sex, more particular, you know, budget as far as, like, income potential. I think it's just somebody who's got a digital issue and they don't know how to deal with it.
And as we start off by saying, perhaps the person who also isn't even aware that they have a digital footprint.
Yeah, I mean, the book will make you pretty surprised at how your own information can be used against you. And how, you know, something you do today can be problematic in a year from now. I mean, law enforcement agencies are asking for access to potential applicants' Facebook accounts. And other companies are asking access to email accounts and other social media accounts. So to a degree, you're being judged not just on your performance on a potential job, but who you are digitally.
The book is called The Digital Hitman. It's written by Frank M. Ahern. Frank, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you, man. Have a great day.
Frank M. Ahern, author of The Digital Hitman. You can visit Frank's website at frankahern.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0146, and you'll find links to Frank's website, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Viewer discretion is advised. But then again, why are you staring at a radio program?
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Bob DiRigo Jones, the guy behind the Wacky Warning Labels contest. Yes, it's another year, so we'll talk about this year's entries. And we have another retro interview. That's an interview we did with somebody who is unfortunately no longer with us, a Hollywood star this time around. We go way back to an interview I did several years ago with Buddy Ebsen. That's coming up a little later on. And, of course, there's an idiot of the day and lots more Stuff File news. Here on the Stuff File program, also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, you know, you can listen to your favorite shows directly from your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and beyond, just about any mobile device. On demand and on the go. If you don't have Stitcher, well, download it for free at Stitcher.com or in the app stores. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, Mel and Joey Schwanke of Fremont, Nebraska, just did a rare thing. They celebrated their 65th wedding anniversary, and yes, they're as happy as ever together. So what's their secret to making love last? Matching outfits. No kidding. And I've seen the pictures. Really, no kidding. For the past 3.5 decades, they've never been seen in public without matching outfits. That means Mel's tie is an exact match to Joey's dress. Mel said, "We don't dare go anywhere without having matching outfits." The two have 146 custom-made matching outfits, and they've been wearing them for so long they don't remember when it started. Now, these days, it sometimes takes a few extra minutes to locate the matches, but 86-year-old Mel and 81-year-old Joey always work it out. Mel says Joey typically gets the honor of picking out the outfits. Of course she does. Of course she does. You know, that's just really so sweet and really so sad all at the same time. And they say true love conquers all. Even, it seems, tornadoes. Caleb and Kendra Pence live in what in Kansas is known as Tornado Alley, and when a developing twister threatened their wedding, neither the couple nor their guests even flinched. Photos and video show the 21-year-old bride in a white gown and the 22-year-old groom in a cowboy hat and jeans happily taking their vows at a family farm while a tornado funnel can clearly be seen just 8 miles off in the distance. The National Weather Service classified it as an F3 storm, packing winds of 138 to 167 miles per hour. "I don't know how on earth I will ever top this," said wedding photographer Kate Emmy, who said she posed the pair for dramatic shots of the newlyweds and the twister behind them. Afterwards, the couple, who met at a rodeo, made a dramatic horseback ride to a metal farm building that was transformed into a reception site. They barely got inside when the skies opened up and poured down rain. The party didn't end until after midnight, and the couple has spent their honeymoon in Wyoming fielding media calls regarding their remarkable wedding photos. Clearly, the couple aren't the brightest bulbs, and we know why their family was there, because, you know, kin stick together. But I hope they paid the photographer extra for her part, because I can't think of many things that would keep me within eyeshot of a tornado to take pictures at somebody's wedding. That's gotta be an amazing fee, that's all I ask. Okay, they say Detroit is the crime capital of the U.S., and here's a good example why. 2 Detroit teens have been wounded after a gunfight broke out because they were arguing over who makes the best Kool-Aid. Yes, witnesses say the two men started screaming at each other, the argument intensified, and then the two idiots started shooting at each other. However, neither shooter hit their intended mark, and it was two innocent bystanders, both 17, who were hit by the stray bullets. One victim was struck in the wrist and the other got a bullet in the rear. Both victims were treated at local hospitals and released. Meanwhile, Detroit police are looking for the two shooting suspects, one of whom reportedly left the scene in a purple 2007 Impala. and there really can't be a lot of them, can there? Although Kool-Aid seems to be one of the least important reasons to fight someone, much less shoot someone, arguments over the popular powdered drink are not unprecedented. Earlier this month, a woman in Florida was arrested for domestic assault after she had a fight with her brother because someone drank his Kool-Aid. You know, it's funny. I, as a child, would gladly sell the stuff to people at a drink stand to make money. As a matter of fact, as a child, I was very successful doing just that. But I was never enamored with the colored sugar water. It's interesting what people will fight over. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, despite being produced in Utah, where the Mormon Church is based, Five Wives Vodka is no longer stocked or special ordered at stores operated by the state of Idaho because Idaho State Liquor Division Administrator Jeff Anderson said the brand is offensive to Mormons, who make up over a quarter of that state's population. The mid-priced vodka label carries the name and an image of five women, an apparent reference to polygamy, a practice abandoned by most Mormons more than a century ago. Meanwhile, Ogden's own distillery, which manufactures Five Wives, is trying to make the most of the press with the media campaign and sale of Free the Five Wives t-shirts. It says the snub is unfair because a Utah beer named Polygamy Porter continues to be sold in Idaho. Anderson said the state of Idaho doesn't decide what beer brands can be sold in grocery and convenience stores. Meanwhile, a spokesperson for Five Wives says, "We have a product that is sold nearly 1,000 cases in 6 months in Utah. If the reaction is because of a religious concern, we think they are extremely misguided." Okay, now, aren't we kind of missing the point here? I thought Mormons couldn't drink alcohol, so how would they even know that this stuff is for sale? I mean, it's not like something they'd be using, assuming they were, you know, good, upstanding Mormons. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Bob DiRigo Jones is a regular contributor to this show. Each week, you hear his Let's Be Fair segments on this program. That'll be coming up a little later on. He's also the guy behind the annual Wacky Warning Labels Contest, which proves just how far companies will go to avoid being sued by consumers for stupid mishaps. If you heard last week's show, then you know that the nominations for the 15th annual contest have been announced. So Bob, who is also the author of Remove the Child Before Folding, 101 Stupidest, Silliest, Wackiest Warning Labels Ever, is on with us once again to talk about this year's entries. He's in Michigan. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Peter. Nice to talk with you here on the 15th anniversary of when we started this contest.
Nice to talk to you, too. So 15 years you're doing this. Are you surprised by how wacky some of these things actually are?
I am. Every year I'm surprised. I remember when I got a call from an editor at Time Warner Books suggesting that we write a book about this based, you know, on the contest. And he had a title of the 101 Wackiest Warning Labels Ever, as you mentioned. And at the time I only had 50, and I thought, geez, how am I ever going to come up with another 51? But we didn't have any problem.
Now, With the proliferation of the internet and kicker stories on newscasts and books like yours and the feature you do that's on our show and stations elsewhere, it's getting out there that there are these wacky warning labels. Aren't judges getting on to this and saying, you know, can't we dial this back a bit?
I believe some are, and that makes us very happy because what we're saying over and over again is that judges need to be the gatekeepers to the courts that they were intended to be, so that when somebody, for example, catches his teeth in a basketball net while dunking a ball and then sues the net maker, that case is dismissed rather than resulting in $50,000 like that one did. So, believe it or not, that's true. And as judges hear us talking about this, but more importantly, as the public becomes aware of how they pay, even if they're never sued themselves, that puts pressure on the judges to do what they're supposed to do.
Has anybody ever given thought to the idea that perhaps maybe one of the things that can be done is to penalize lawyers who bring forward frivolous lawsuits?
Well, it's a great idea, and there's been much debate about that. Is it just how far we can go in penalizing them? in America, we do not have, as you have in Canada and as the rest of the world really has, a loser pay system where if you sue somebody and lose, you pay their legal bills. So we've done that to some extent with frivolous cases. And many states will have laws on the books that say if you bring a frivolous case and lose, you must pay the legal bills. But the stickler is that judges very rarely will define a lawsuit as frivolous. And if they do, it's even more rare for them to kick in the section of the law that requires the payment of those legal bills. So we've got a long way to go, and we're up against decades and decades of precedent here in the United States before we overturn that.
So you've had the opportunity to do this contest every year, and people are aware of the wacky warning labels. Have you had an opportunity to talk to any of these companies, and more importantly, I guess these companies' attorneys, because they're, I'm sure, the ones who are involved in drafting some of these wacky warning labels. Do you ever talk to them and find out what goes through their mind when they do this, and they kind of sheepishly look at you and say, yeah, we know, but we kind of have to?
Yes, we do. And one of the first things I always mention is that the purpose of the contest isn't to embarrass a company or to make fun of them. It's to point out the unpredictability of a legal climate where they're forced to operate in and where they have to put warning labels on. So we try to break the ice by making sure that they know why we're doing this. It's public education. It's not out to make fun of them. And sometimes we will get more of an in-depth explanation of why the label was there. We'll get the stories of the lawsuits. Sometimes we're more successful when we're able to reach the CEO of the company, who really is the one that has his or her neck out on the line and really feels these lawsuits very personally every time they're filed. When we speak with the lawyers, who tend to be, might be surprising to some of your listeners, a very conservative group, by and large, they don't like to talk about these. For one, and I can understand this, is they don't want to encourage copycat lawsuits. You know, there's one lawsuit that everybody in North America has heard about, and that's the spilled coffee lawsuit. What many people might be surprised to learn is that there have been so many mom-and-pop restaurants and other establishments that have been sued since then by people trying to strike it rich, so to speak, in the lawsuit lottery that the courts have become. So the lawyers tend not to want to get this in the media because they just want it to go away as quickly as possible.
I'd almost be tempted to put up a sign saying, "The coffee's hot, deal with it."
Yeah, well, you know, one of my favorite stories is a guy who started a museum in St. Louis, and it's the most popular attraction in the whole city. It's geared toward children. It gets about 1 million visitors a year, and he got so exasperated with the lawsuits that somebody would file claiming to have tripped, and then video surveillance would show that they never tripped, or whatever they claimed happened didn't happen, that he put a surcharge of $1 on the ticket and a sign at the entrance of the museum saying the $1 of each ticket was going to pay for the frivolous lawsuits that they had to deal with every year.
Wow. So what are some of the wacky warning labels that are in this year's contest?
Well, in no particular order, there's one on an electric razor for men. It's the rotary style that many people are familiar with. But it warns, never use while sleeping. Okay. And you know the funny thing about that, Peter, is that we have seen that particular warning, not to use while sleeping, on a whole wide range of healthcare products, whether it's a blow dryer, a curling iron, so on and so forth. And I think what has happened over the years is that anybody who makes a product never knows what the next lawsuit is going to be, so they just start slapping a warning label that might be on this product, on another product that they might make, thinking that it will protect them from a lawsuit. So you see a hairdryer, for example, that comes with a 14-page user guide, and half of it is warnings about what not to do.
Wow. What are some of the other ones that are in this year's?
I like this one. It's a neck pillow produced and marketed for children. It's a cute little thing that people might remember these or have seen these as a little half donut that you put around a child's head when they're riding in a car seat. Well, it's made for children, but it says, warning, keep product away from infants and children.
Wow.
Unbelievable. That's pretty good, but how about this one? This is an electric skillet, and it says, caution, griddle surface may be hot during and after cooking. They'd probably be sued if it wasn't.
Oh, man. have we just ceased taking responsibility for our own actions? Is that what's happened?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because we often talk about how much these lawsuits cost, but the bottom line is it's all about personal responsibility. And the answer is yes, some people have. I believe it's still a very small minority of all the people who are buying products. But since you have to insure for just that one, and all of the lawsuits that produce these types of warning labels have one thing in common. They always say you failed to warn. So years ago, and not that long ago, things started changing in the 60s and in the 70s. Courts began being more willing to overlook responsibility. There's been a doctrine in law for centuries, at least decades, going way, way back, over 100 years, called the open and obvious doctrine, where if you ignored a danger that was open and obvious to the normal average person, that you could not sue if you injured yourself. As that has eroded that doctrine, we need these common sense warnings. And it's all about our effort is trying to bring personal responsibility back.
What if a company decided to put on a warning label that said, warning, not responsible for your stupidity?
We've seen those. And we've seen long. Now, the labels are starting to become tongue-in-cheek by some. I think they've heard about the contest and they're just having a little bit of fun. So we've seen warning labels that says, if you cannot read or understand English, we're absolved from any responsibility. So on and so forth. My favorite, I think the warning label that basically covers everything, was found a couple of years ago by a fellow in Michigan, and it says, warning, avoid death. So that was on a bulldozer.
Now, how do you go about picking the winner, and when will the winner be picked?
The winner is picked from the five finalists on a national television audience that airs on Fox. John Stossel is the host. We used to give away a book by John Stossel, and then we decided, let's just bring this to his audience, let them pick the cash prize winners. We give $1,000 to the person who finds the funniest label, and $500 to the second place, and $250 to the third place.
You said initially that you didn't know if you're going to have $101 for the book. You're never going to run out, are you?
No, I'm thinking of writing another book called The Labels We Can't Talk About on Radio, because we get some doozies too.
Wow. Bob, always a pleasure to have you on the program. People can check out the website and also check out the book. And of course, coming up in just a matter of moments, another one of your segments on Let's Be Fair. I thank you for being on the program with us.
Always nice to talk with you, Peter. Thank you.
Bob DiRigo-Jones, radio host and author of Remove the Child Before Folding, 101 Stupidest, Silliest, Wackiest Warning Labels Ever, which is published by Grand Central Publishing. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0146, and you'll find links to Bob's website. And coming up right now, this week's edition of Let's Be Fair. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. In the first year of our wacky warning label contest, one of the labels came from a beach towel. It had little weights in the corners, and it warned, during a hurricane or other severe weather conditions, this product should not be used to secure yourself. Now, I've seen some pretty funny labels, but that one has always made me wonder. The labels in our contest are there because of frivolous lawsuits, but could a lawsuit really have prompted such a warning on a towel about high winds? Well, this week I got my answer. In a similar scenario, a Rotary Club in California is being sued by a woman who was carried off by a gust of wind at one of the group's events. To protect herself from the winds, the woman had grabbed one of their tents, and the tent then blew 10 feet in the air. Let's be fair, the tent did not have a label warning that that could happen, and that is the basis of the lawsuit. Yes, we truly live in a lawsuit-happy culture. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
This is The Stuff File.
It's time for another retro interview with a celebrity that is no longer with us. Over the last 25 years or so, I've had the pleasure to talk with some great stars of the past. This time around, it's a chat that I had back in March of 1994. The star was born Christian Rudolph Ebsen Jr., but we knew him best as Buddy. And he's best known for his role as Jed Clampett on the Beverly Hillbillies and as Detective Barnaby Jones. At the time that we spoke, he was promoting his just-released autobiography. It was called The Other Side of Oz, a title that brings reference to the fact that he was originally cast as the Tin Woodsman in The Wizard of Oz. At the time that we talked, Buddy was just a month shy of his 86th birthday. Here is just a part of that hour-long interview now.
I guess we should start right at the top and talk about your book and the title. I'm sure people by now are familiar with the story, but for those who are not, tell us about your recollections of that movie, which you should have been in, but unfortunately were not.
Well, I was in it for 10 days.
It's true, yeah.
And then because I was playing the Tin Woodman, they powdered me with aluminum dust, and it got into my lungs, and I got instant emphysema, and it was pretty serious, so I was replaced. And the book, it recalls those days, but that's not what it's entirely about. It's about my life in show business since 1928, when I first came to New York.
You've had a very long and illustrious career. Touching on that Oz situation just for a little bit, I guess people are familiar with the fact that you were to play the Tin Woodsman. But if you go back a little further, I understand you actually wanted to play the role of the Scarecrow.
Well, I was a tab for the role of Scarecrow, and then they shifted me to the Tin Woodman because a very natural Scarecrow dancer came on the lot. Mm-hmm. And I was fine in the Tin Woodman until the makeup. And, of course, the tin suit was a problem, too, because right. They had never made a tin suit before. And I luckily survived the whole ordeal.
You were almost like a guinea pig in that movie, the way they tested you.
Yes.
Yeah, and all the work you had to go through before you even shot any of the footage. And I understand that there is actually a possibility that you might actually be in that film.
Well, I think that after they replaced me, they discovered that you couldn't recognize who was in the suit at a certain distance. So I think that in order to save film, they just used some of the existing stuff.
So some of the footage, for instance, like when you're all skipping down the yellow brick road, that might actually be you?
That could be, yes.
And I understand you might actually be on the soundtrack, too.
Well, I think I actually am. I think they definitely identified me on the soundtrack. When we're off to see The Wizard, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. You know that song?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Now, again, for a large part of the population, the baby boomer generation and up, they might not even know you as a song and dance man. They know you as either Jed Clampett or Barnaby Jones.
That's true. Some of the younger folks don't know that I started out as a song and dance man in New York in Broadway shows in the late 20s and early 30s. And I still do that. I play in Branson and places with my act, and I do sing and dancing and jokes.
How did you get into this whole song and dance and acting routine? Because I understand you were actually a pre-med student?
I was. I wanted to be a doctor, but ran out of money when the Florida boom collapsed, and that's where we lived. And so my father was a dancing teacher, and unlike the shoemaker's children, all his children did not go barefoot. They learned a trade.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a trade I fell back on and decided to go to New York and see how far I could get.
Now, the strongest part of your career through the whole years you've been around in entertainment has to have been television.
But yes, it was almost like it was invented to sell Ebsen. I don't act on broad lines, and this supplied a certain intimacy that seemed to communicate to a multitude of people.
Well, the reason why I asked that question is because when you first went into show business, television wasn't even around. So what were your goals? Did you want to go to Broadway? Did you want to go into movies?
I just wanted to keep working.
Well, you've done that very successfully for a long period of time.
Yes, I've been blessed.
How did you get the role of Jed Clampett, which you played for 9 years?
Well, the had the theory that most successful series were built around a tall man, and I qualified. So that was instrumental in the first moves toward getting the part.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but for most of your career, before Jed Clampett and before Barnaby Jones, you played second bananas or sidekicks or the hero's best friend, stuff like that. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just didn't have a leading man's nose. You have to have a straight sort of, I don't know, heroic sort of a nose. Mine was, I had a sidekick's nose.
So was it a surprise to you later in life that you started getting the lead?
Yes. It was a pleasant surprise. Somehow the lead gets more respect on the set than anyone else. I enjoyed it.
I understand. I heard a story talking about bumping you around from role to role, from the Scarecrow to the Tin Man, and unfortunately out, that even when you did Davy Crockett, you were hoping to play Davy?
Originally, for about 2 minutes, I was supposed to be Davy, and then Disney saw Fess Parker in a two-minute role in a picture called Them. It was about giant ants. And he said, that's Davy Crockett. So it was quite painful for a few days until they decided that Davy had a friend and I was a friend, Georgie Russell.
Talking about your dancing, you had a chance to dance with Shirley Temple.
Yes, I did.
Now,
that was quite an experience. She's at the age of six, she had the aplomb and the poise and the intelligence of a grown-up.
Now, that was certainly a difference at that time, a difference in height.
Yes, well, we cured that by having her, lifting her up on this big sort of hogshead tub and dancing around it with her on the, reducing the disparity in her height.
Mm-hmm. That was the movie, I guess, Captain January?
That's right.
At a time when a lot of people are taking it easy and slowing down, you sign up for a television show that runs another 7 years, Barnaby Jones.
Yeah, it was only supposed to run one half a season, but it fooled them.
It was only supposed to run a half a season?
Pardon?
It was only supposed to run a half of a half.
It was really concocted in a hurry to replace an hour that fell out on the CBS programming.
Mm-hmm.
So they figured, it was only good for 13 weeks.
Had you not?
But the ratings, were so, good and unpredictable. They were afraid to cancel it.
Had you known that it was going to go on for 7 years, would you have been willing to sign up?
Sure. It was fun doing. I mean, I didn't have to put on much makeup. I was more or less myself, and it was very comfortable.
Most of the people had known you, as of course, by that point, from Jed Clampett, and before that, A Song and Dance Man, also on Davy Crockett. This was quite of a change. You had done musical comedy. You had done comedy. Weren't they worried about you being typecast as Jed Clampett? What would Jed Clampett be doing as a detective?
As I said, Barnaby Jones was more naturally me than Jed. I characterized more as Jed Clampett. So it was easy to, make the transition.
Since you say most people think of you as Jed Clampett, do you find that that sometimes is difficult? They meet you and they think you are Jed Clampett? They expect you to be Jed Clampett?
No, I just give them a big grin and they forget all about that and say, hiya, buddy, Okay. I have no problem with switching roles socially.
There are so many books out there that come out from actors written either by them or about them, and a lot of times you hear stories about people who have books, and they're relatively young. You have had such a vast career, such a long career, yet you waited till now to write this book. Why now?
Well, I was gathering notes. I really didn't have time. But my mother, when I started out into the world, she said, son, you're going to meet a lot of interesting folks out there, so why don't you just jot down notes about them and things that you do, and then one day you will write a book. So I've been all this time collecting material, and finally the opportunity came. I was approached by Donovan Publishing to publish my book, and so I got everything together, and there it is.
So through the entire run of the Beverly Hillbillies, people have said, even though so many people love watching the show on the air, and it it's reflected in the ratings. There were those who knocked it. Critics knocked it, saying that it was idiotic or it was moronic. How did you take to the criticism of the show?
Well, when it was first reviewed, there were 19 critics who said it was, quote, corny, unquote. And so I wrote letters thanking them for their reviews and asking them what corny means. And how many letters do you think I got back?
None.
Nobody could really identify the word. And to me, corny means the emotions that you feel when the big chips are down, like when a child is sick, or, you know, when you're in deep trouble. And the Hillbillies touched on an understanding of that, those moments, plus a feeling and a talent for humor, which did not really destroy, but which, as I say, it mentally healed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a kindly show and a funny show. That is my identification of the Hillbillies.
That was part of an interview with actor Buddy Ebsen from March of 1994. Buddy died of pneumonia in Torrance, California on July 6, 2003. He was 95. You can hear the full hour-long interview with Buddy on my website at thestufffile.com. Click on Celebrity Audio Files and you'll find the interview with Buddy and also interviews with others. They're all listed in alphabetical order and you can play them right off the page.
The Stuff File.
And we're in the home stretch. We just have a few more stories to share with you before we get to our idiot of the day. Life must be pretty boring when you're so rich you make paper airplanes out of cash and send it floating down to the masses below. That's what 27-year-old Russian millionaire Pavel Durov did, behavior that earned him plenty of new critics, as the mogul threw paper planes made of money from the windows of his St. Petersburg office into a growing crowd of pedestrians below. Durov is the CEO of In Contact, that's the Russian version of Facebook, a growing crowd amassed to collect the 5,000 ruble notes, which are worth about $160 each. However, while Durov reportedly appeared amused by the crowd, he stopped after a few spectators appeared to turn violent. Durov later tweeted, "We had to stop soon, though, as people turned into animals." Yes, some people have more dollars than cents. Meanwhile, still with Facebook, Facebook just can't get a break in the bad press department these days. As the horror of the Facebook IPO continues to capture headlines, police in St. Petersburg, that's the one in Florida, have now arrested a 46-year-old woman they say choked a teen boy in the middle of Tyrone Square Mall because she didn't like the comments he posted on Facebook that upset her daughter. Debbie Pisticella and her 14-year-old daughter were at the mall when the girl spotted the boy near Sears. The mother confronted the teen after the daughter pointed him out. Mom apparently became incensed, and police spokesman Mike Pewitt said she put her hands around the throat and started to choke the boy. The 14-year-old boy, who was not identified, called police as Debbie continued to berate him. An officer responded and called the boy's mother, who initially said she didn't want to press charges, but then changed her mind after she saw the red marks on his neck. Debbie has been charged with child abuse, although she claims she only touched the boy's neck accidentally. Unfortunately for her, those malls have security cameras everywhere, and the tapes don't lie. Police would not say what the boy had posted on Facebook. But you know, if the daughter is like the mother, maybe whatever the kid wrote isn't that inaccurate. Anyway, that's a dumb parent, but she didn't make idiot of the day. However, this next person did make the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
Proving there will never be a shortage of really dumb crooks, 24-year-old Robert Bennett of Marina, California, confirmed he's not ready for primetime crime after allegedly stealing a cash register from the Ho Wha Chinese restaurant. Police believe the gun he threatened the cashier with was only his finger in his coat pocket. Bennett reportedly ordered the employee to empty the cash register, but the employee just kind of froze. So Bennett then just grabbed the entire register and made his way out the door. The problem is the cash register weighed over 50 pounds, and he made it only about 100 yards before giving up and leaving it behind. He did manage to stuff about $200 from the register into his pockets, but police response was so quick and Bennett's escape was so slow due to carrying the heavy register that officers quickly spotted him. One officer said they chased Bennett through a carport, almost like a Keystone Cops thing, until he just kind of gave up. He was arrested on felony and misdemeanor charges, including robbery, victim witness intimidation, destruction of evidence, and resisting arrest. Now, what kind of robber has a plan to lug a large, heavy cash register out of the place of business that he robbed? Well, one kind and one kind only. An idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0146. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you can find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0146. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been getting jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mama jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.